Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to UFO Think Tank with your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Well, hello again, my friends. This is Alejandro Rojas with UFO Think Tank. We have a wonderful show this evening. One of my greatest heroes in the field. And of course, you know, some people are into TV shows and things like that. Some people are into football or sports, and I'm obviously into ufology. So if I were to go spend money, you know, I went and saw the Dalai Lama at our Pepsi Center. That was pretty awesome. But if I was going to spend some money to see someone, it would be tonight's guest, Dr. Leo Sprinkle. Really, there are, in this field, I have a few favorites. John Schuchler, who is the director of MUFON, is a big favorite of mine. John Mack, who unfortunately passed away, is a big favorite of mine. And this gentleman, Dr. Leo Sprinkle, who we're going to talk to tonight, is also one of my greatest heroes in the field. You may have known of him. If you look into UFOs and do a lot of research, you're going to see his name pop up all over the place because really, along with Bud Hopkins, he's been researching the abduction phenomena or the experiencer phenomena, which he calls it and John Mack called it and others, for decades. Dr. Sprinkle, he's a doctor in psychology. He worked at the University of Wyoming and was director of their counseling services department for many years. However, when he was still in school right here in Colorado in Boulder, he saw a UFO and he saw another one with his now wife in college, and that started making him think, hey, I think there's something to this subject. So we'll talk more about that, but then when he became a psychologist, he took this seriously, and he studied it and studied the people who claimed to have experiences. So we'll talk about his early days and how that worked out. And so for decades, he was tied to some of the real big cases in ufology for a long time. So we'll talk about those decades of work. You'll see his name coming up in multiple times. In fact, some of the original, for instance, Dulce, New Mexico, some of you may have heard that there's a base under there. And one of the things I had read, it was actually during one of Dr. Sprinkle's regressions where someone had talked about that, and that started to become popular. So we'll talk about that period, some of the difficulties that he had, obviously working at the University of Wyoming as a professor and being interested in this field because, of course, now, you know, we have some of these people like Dr. Sprinkle, like Bud Hopkins, like John Mack, who have really gotten this subject out there and have done some of the work, groundbreaking work, to make it easier for those of us today. But back when there weren't many people into this stuff, it was harder to do this, and you had some of your peers giving you a lot of trouble. So we'll talk about some of that. He has a fascinating book out that talks about his experiences in the past, and we'll talk about that. So we've got a lot to talk about with Dr. Sprinkle, a big friend of mine, and We'll bring him on in just a second, but as usual, I want to talk about some UFO news. Oh, and by the way, you know, I did want to add something. If you don't know, I'm the director of research for MUFON, Mutual UFO Network. That's the largest UFO investigation organization. I do lots of interviews for that organization. And, of course, we're very conservative. And, in fact, one of the stories we're going to talk about tonight, and I might as well talk about it now, are the fireballs that people have been seeing. So what seems to be large meteorites coming down. And there was also the sighting and the video taking during the inauguration on CNN that people had talked about. And that's some video you can go check out. But, you know, I've been on some radio shows recently. I do radio, and I do a lot of the media spots for MUFON, and they've been asking about these events. And, you know, unfortunately, I don't have much to say, and it's kind of a double-edged sword, and that's what I want to talk about at first here. On the one hand, of course, we're very conservative. If we don't have anything to substantiate, for instance, that these fireballs are UFOs, I'm not going to go out putting MUFON's name on the line, saying, oh, yeah, these are UFOs, these are probably extraterrestrial. We don't have any evidence to support that. So I'm not going to be able to do that. If we got some evidence, I'd be able to more confidently go out and say, hey, you know, these are definitely UFOs. Certainly nobody knows what they are at this time, and people are looking into it, and I can't wait till we find out more. But the same goes for the inauguration. You know, we don't know what that was. I've seen some videos where I thought, that looks like a UFO. I look further into it, and it turns out to be a bird. And I know now that a lot of these times, you know, I'll get a duped video that's emailed to me that's not as high resolution as the original. And the better resolution, the more data you have. So on the one hand, we're very conservative. We're, you know, some of these radio stations get a little disappointed that I'm not coming out and saying, oh, yeah, look, those were UFOs. I don't have any proof to prove something like that. On the flip side, especially on my show here, I'm friends with a lot of people in this field. And a lot of people in the field are more willing to go out there and speculate or at least go into those arenas to talk about some of this stuff. And, of course, not everybody holds, you know, everybody as far as what's evidence, what's substantiated, and what's not, everybody kind of has their own line. And funny thing is, I did get a little criticism lately on my associations, associating myself with people in this field who they feel aren't scientifically rigorous enough, who go out and speculate and talk about things that they can't prove. And you know what? I just feel that MUFON is a group to be conservative, but we need all different types of people. We need all of the different types of people looking into all of the different areas. And I'm not going to call someone not my friend because they're looking into things that I don't necessarily feel are I don't agree with them. And I'm not going to throw someone's life of work out the window just because they're looking into something that I don't agree to or they're making statements that I personally feel are a little far-fetched, because I'm sure I make some statements that are far-fetched. Some people know I'm associated to the Stan Romanek case, and people get frustrated about that, and I understand that. In this case, I've had personal experiences with him, and so I can't throw my personal experience out of the window. So hopefully people understand that. I try to keep an open mind. I think it's important to keep an open mind and that we at least hear people out. You don't have to agree with everybody that's on my show. I certainly don't agree with everybody on my show, even though a lot of these guys are some of my good buddies. So I just wanted to mention that just to, so you guys have my point of view. And hopefully any of those people listening who may have felt, you know, or sent any criticism, hopefully that explains myself. If not, you know, I think we're all just trying to do our best here. But getting into the UFO news, let's see here. We've got a lot going on because we haven't talked for the last couple of weeks. I had some busy stuff going on last week and wasn't able to do a show. But we have some great stuff coming from the National UFO Examiner. If you haven't seen examiner.com, it's a new website that has a lot of news, and they have local examiners. So whatever area you're in one of the towns local to you, maybe they've got the Chicago UFO Examiner or the Chicago Beer Examiner or the Chicago Progressive Examiner or something like that. where they talk about subjects and they kind of write blogs. Speaking of the Chicago UFO Examiner, Roger Marsh, he was stepped up. He's actually helping me out, and he's our director of communications for MUFON, and he's been made the National Examiner, and he's got some great stories. In fact, if you go to his website now, he's got some video that he put up. It hasn't been totally analyzed yet, so, you know, a lot of the cases we get for MUFON will at least show the video or promote the video, because I think it's fair to have people look at it, see what they think before we claim one way or the other or do our full investigation. But he's got some video from Florida in a hunting camp where some people took some videos. So that's really cool. He just posted that story. And actually, another story he had just posted was some reports from six states. So UFOs that happened from six states in a different area. So that's some good stuff. So you want to check out his Examiner URL. And remember, a lot of this stuff I'm talking about, you can go to UFO Think Tank and you'll see that on the bottom of the front page, or you can go to Yahoo Groups and check for UFO Think Tank, and you can join my email list and I'll email this stuff out to you. You can also look at my Facebook, UFO Think Tank Facebook, and see some of this stuff too. So I always love to have more friends on Facebook. So the Examiner, some cool stuff coming out there. Other UFO news. Breaking news about Canada. Last week, if you listen to UFO Not Radio, something I pop in on Sunday evenings, we talked about Canada opening their UFO files. And actually, since we've been corrected that Canada hasn't reopened its UFO files, these files actually have been available for years. And somebody just sent out a press release that it was something new when it wasn't. But still, a lot of people aren't aware that Canada does have a lot of UFO files available, and you can go to a URL and check those out. So I'm sure there's some interesting stuff there. Other stories, Spiegel Online, which seems to be a really big international online magazine, has a story about an artist who is exploring the myth of Nazi UFO technology. So some of you may know that it is rumored the Nazis were working on UFOs and working on anti-gravity ships that either were back-engineered from UFOs or just their own technology, that they looked like the classic silver discs, and a lot of what we see were actually Nazi technology and not UFOs. So interesting theories. That's something you may want to look into. But what this artist has done is kind of recreated some of these craft or supposed craft from some of the supposed pictures that are out there. So it's something interesting to look into. I know William Byrd did some, he was the guy who did some research in the Antarctic and stuff like that, and they had said he had an encounter with Fugelrods, these guys who had created these UFOs that said they shared the, or actually ETs who shared their technology with Germans. So interesting stuff, stuff you may want to look into. Also, Cambridge Journals, the International Journal of Astrobiology. This is that actually came out in a SETI story. If you're a math guy, you might like this story. This stuff's way over my head, but a lot of equations they're working on that further conclude that most likely there's a lot of life out there, that there are a lot of planets with life. You may be familiar with the Drake equation, which tries to calculate how many planets have civilizations are there, on there, and the results are a lot of huge numbers. Frank Drake, the guy who came up with the equation, is part of SETI, but a lot of people working on that. So if you're interested in the Drake equation and you're some kind of math guru, you may want to go check out the latest on this. UFOs over Arizona, again, got a story posted on that. A UFO with some very interesting pictures from Russia. So I've got a story that I haven't posted yet, but will post momentarily on UFOs in Russia. And then also a couple stories on Britain. Of course, there's always something going on in Britain. And the latest is a pretty interesting UFO video of a UFO long cylindrical type object flying over a campsite in the UK. Is it a UFO? I don't know, some people speculating it could be some balloon that just looks larger than it is, but still, it's some really neat video. So hopefully we'll get some more information on what's going on with that. And you have, if you haven't heard this one also, the UK, at least the Sun has reported that sightings doubled in 2008 in Britain. And one of the stories they also released were UFO sightings over the Parliament. So a lot of stuff coming out of the UK. Speaking of the UK, we've got the best guy in the world who could speak to UK UFOs, Nick Pope. He's going to be on the show next week. Of course, he is in the UK, so I've got to change my show hours. Going to do it at noon, so that's the evening for him, because if I did my regular time, he'd have to wake up in the middle of the night and do the show, which he does a lot when he's doing shows over here. You may have seen him recently on CNN or Fox News talking about the British UFO files. And Nick Pope actually worked for the Ministry of Defense on UFO files. So he investigated UFOs officially for the British government. So obviously he's a great authority. He has some incredible information, and he's been watching very closely the UFO files that have been released in Britain. And there's a lot of great stuff in there. So he's going to talk about that. We'll also talk about how it seems like almost on at least a monthly, if not biweekly basis, the British news is picking up a story from those files, really blowing it up and really talking about it, getting in all the papers. And some of those stories are bleeding over and coming into the U.S. So I've even gotten phone calls for MUFON from some of the press when some of these stories get big. So I'll talk about that, and we'll talk about some of those stories that have gotten really big in the last few months that have come from the UK. So that's going to be a great show. But speaking of a great show, let's get on with today's show. We've got Dr. Leo Sprinkle. I noticed there's some people in the chat. Feel free to ask your questions or feel free to give us a call. But let's bring on, I always say with every guest, this is one of my favorite people. Here's another one of my favorite people. I just like people. But Dr. Sprinkle, are you on?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much, Alejandro.
Excellent. Thank you very much for being on. So it's, how's the weather out there? You're out in Wyoming. It's pretty cool.
Laramie, usually. Wyoming, yes. It's usually around 30, 40 degrees high and 10, 20 degrees low.
Geek, how you hanging on out there in that kind of weather?
Doing well.
Yep, I know. And just on a personal note, you're even a much more physical guy than I am, unfortunately. I should be more physical myself, but if you don't mind sharing your age, I think you're in the 70s?
Uh-huh. Well, I'm eternal, but my body is 78,
right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The soul is eternal. My wife and I get up at 4:30 in the morning. We do our stretches. We go to the gym at 6, and I work out with weights or swimming or shooting the basketball, and then I can go to the office and rest.
Yeah. And you play some basketball, right?
Yeah. I haven't played for the last couple of years. It's hard to get the guys who are 75 to 79-year-old together for a team. So
yeah.
So I just shoot baskets and swim during Senior Olympics.
Yep. You got to play the young guys. And
right.
Do you still do some of those jumping windmill dunks?
never was able to do that, but I enjoy shooting the ball.
Cool. All right. Well, I think I would like to go kind of in a chronological order. You've done so much in this field, but there's some points because, you know, we get to meet once in a while here and there, but there's a lot of questions that I've wanted to ask you because, of course, in my research, your name comes up occasionally. But let's start off, I guess, with your first couple of UFO sightings. What got you really interested in UFOs?
Yeah, in 1949, a buddy and I at the University of Colorado went to a meeting on scientific exploration, and we were playing a little game when we came out of the Arts and Science building one fall afternoon. We were saying, what do you see over there? Well, I call it a tree. Well, how do you describe it? And so we were looking at things from a perspective about what we could identify. and we looked up in the southwest sky, and we saw what looked like an elliptical object. Don't know whether the sun was shining on the rim or whether there was an internal locus of light, but I saw it as a flying saucer. And of course, I was a scoffer in those days, and I was puzzled. My buddy and I talked about it, but then afterwards, I didn't want to talk about it with anybody. It just sounded too weird. My views and religion were affected. Well, then in 1956, my wife and I were coming back from Denver, and we saw in the evening sky what we thought was an evening star, a planet. But it began to move, so I stopped the car. We got out and watched as it apparently descended. My wife saw it as back and forth, kind of a pendulum motion. I perceived it as a falling leaf pattern. When we got out, we could see that the light or the object, whatever it was below the Flatirons of the Rocky Mountain foothills. So we watched it for several minutes. It would hover, and it would move and hover, no sound. And so I knew it wasn't an airplane or a helicopter. It didn't seem to be a balloon or a flare or anything. So I changed from being a skeptic to an unwilling believer, knowing that I had seen something unusual, and I figured other people saw it too. So I assumed that the next day there'd be something in the newspaper or radio, but nothing. And so I had this sinking feeling, uh-oh, I've got to study these phenomena. And I knew it was going to be lonely business.
Right. And it has been, I'm sure, over the years, huh?
Yes. In 1961, after I finished the doctorate in counseling psychology at the University of Missouri, I went to the University of North Dakota in Grand Forks. And that first year, I began a study of NICAP, National Investigation Committee on Aerial Phenomena, asking people to fill out information about background and their interests and so forth. Then I tried to study with my colleagues, other psychologists, and it failed. So I said to myself, okay, I'll do a study with the experts. I'll ask people who claim to have been on board to give information about their background, about ESP, because by that time I knew that paranormal phenomena were reported with UFO sightings, and also ask them to fill out information about their ET encounters and any communication. And so in 1963, 1964, I started the study, and some people were willing to fill out the personality inventories as well as the surveys. Continued that study when I went to the University of Wyoming in 64, and still continue. In fact, I've gotten a couple of surveys this past week, one man in Ohio, another man in West Virginia. Both have had many, many experiences lifelong and are willing to describe the events. Now I don't ask people to fill out personality inventories because in 1985, Dr. June Parnell finished her dissertation at the university, and she had reported on over 200 people describing their experiences as well as taking personality inventories. And the MMPI profiles, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, indicated that these people are, quote, normal, unquote. Of course, there are variations on the profile, but in general, we know over years and years of investigations that most people who report flying saucers or encounters with ETs are, quote, normal in terms of their psychological profile. But we also know that these people are sometimes traumatized because they not only are puzzled by their experiences, but they sometimes are ridiculed by other people around them, and that makes it more difficult for them to deal with it.
Right. So I want to ask, when did you first come across the notion of people being taken or having experiences?
That was in the 60s. I was working with APRO, Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, Jim and Coral Lorenzen, and their first two consultants, Dr. Frank Salisbury and Dr. Jim Harder, were interested not only in the physical aspects, the biological aspects of flying saucers and what they call flying saucer occupants, but they were also interested in the psychological aspects of people who reported these and the parapsychological effects, the phenomena, you know, missing time. We call it loss of time. Later, Bud Hopkins called it missing time. And we tried to talk with these people to find out more about not only who they were, but also what they were reporting. First experience in hypnosis I had was in the middle 60s with a guy from Denver that Mr. and Mrs. Trimhol of Boulder asked me to talk with. And then a year, during that same year, I worked with a young woman at the University of Wyoming who had had a strange experience outside of town along with her boyfriend, some kind of encounter. So I went along continuing to work with these people, not only in terms of hypnosis sessions, but also corresponding with a lot of people, going to a lot of conferences, Brazil and other nations. So it's been a marvelous ride.
Mm-hmm. Now, what did you think when you first heard of this? I don't know. Was the first time you heard of this sort of experience, the Betty and Barney Hill, when that happened?
Yeah, in 1966, I was invited to a TV program in New York City, NBC program. And one program was Our Flying Saucers, Fact or Fiction, along with other professional people. But another show was with Betty and Barney Hill, Dr. Carl Sagan, and a couple other science writers. We talked with Betty and Barney about their experience. And that's when I got the idea that I could continue doing what Benjamin Simon, Dr. Simon, the psychiatrist, had done, do these kind of hypnosis sessions with people. I'd had formal training, and so I thought, that's good. I can talk with people, and maybe I can help them learn more about their experiences.
Mm-hmm. So do you think, in your experience, was the Betty and Barney Hill thing the first event of this nature?
No, there was a man out of Brazil,
okay.
Dr. Olavo Fontes, who is an MD, doctor of medicine, who was working with a man, Antonio Villas Boas. That was in the 50s, late 50s. Jim Harder worked with some people using a pendulum technique and talked about the possibility that we could do more work. So some people think that I was the first to do that, but Jim Harder was the first as far as I'm concerned. Of course, even though there were cases, these are thought to be early cases as far as modern sightings are concerned, well, there have been reports of people, you know, for thousands of years, biblical stories of Elijah or other men who went on board what might be called a cloud from heaven or chariots of the sky and so forth. So these kind of reports have been around for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm. When you first heard of these reports of your colleague in Brazil and Betty and Barney, what did you think? Were you very open to the idea when you first heard of them?
Yes, puzzled in some ways, but open to it because of my own childhood experiences. When I was a kid, I'd had bloody noses, I had strange dreams. Of course, when I became a psychology student, I just attributed this to nightmares and, you know, psychological explanations. But finally, I had enough courage when I was 50 years old to go through hypnosis with another psychologist, and I went back to what seemed to be a 1940 experience when I was 10 years old. On board a craft, a tall man on my left holding my shoulder with his hand, and he was saying to me, or thinking to me, "Leo, learn to read and write well. When you grow up, you can help other people learn more about their purpose in life." So I didn't accept it right away, you know, being a skeptical, scientific-minded psychologist. But 10 years later, when I was 60, at a UFO conference that we had each year at the University of Wyoming, a young woman from Denver was talking about her experience and viewing the ET with a long silver spacesuit with the feet extended like a child's pajamas, you know, they're built into the suit. I started to sob, and tears coming to my eyes, and somebody in the audience said, "Good, Leo's suffering like the rest of us." what was happening was that my memories, the body memories, were such that they were overpowering, and I was weeping, knowing that the experience happened. So I could no longer be skeptical. I could accept the possibility. Other people could say, well, Leo's crazy or Leo's silly. He didn't have that experience. But I could no longer deny it. I knew that I'd been on board a craft when I was a kid. I knew that this experience is part of what a lot of people are experiencing. Part of the experiences are not only human experiences, but also past life experiences, and that's why I wanted to study reincarnation as well as the UFO experiences.
Yeah, and we'll get into some of this. I was going to say, now, I would agree with the people who say you're silly because I know you have a sense of humor. But the crazy part, yeah, I don't think you're so crazy. But yeah, I want to get into those, the past life and the experiences that people are reporting and your experiences also. But I'm interested in some of the early research that was going on in the 60s too. I mean, when in the mid-60s, once the Betty and Barney Hill started coming out, were there then a kind of a boom of these people that were coming to you with similar experiences?
Yes. They were always shy. Sometimes people were reluctant to talk about the experiences. Sometimes they felt driven to talk about them. But Betty and Barney Hill's story was 61, and then Fuller wrote their book, and so I met them in 66, but they had already been willing to participate in 1963-64 in the survey that I was conducting. So they took personality inventories and completed the survey. And there were other people. I asked various APRO people to send people my way, or NICAP people. NICAP was less willing to deal with that. They wanted to deal with the physical aspects, but they were not so likely to deal with the reports of flying saucer occupants. Other organizations were willing to refer people to me, and so I would ask persons to participate. And over the years, I'd get many people each year who would participate.
Mm-hmm. So, and then was over at least the next couple of decades even, did you see kind of a steady number of these people, or did you see periods of time where there are more than others?
I stopped counting the number of people I worked with in hypnosis at 500 because it just was getting, my wife knew I was crazy, busy hours at the university and then also on weekends driving to other states and talking to people, seeing if we could help them understand more. Eventually, people wanted to get together. They said, Leo, bring us together. And I said, we don't have any funds. I've tried to get funds from UFO Fund or other places. But they said, well, that's okay. Just call us together and we'll pay our own way. So in 1980, we set up a conference at the University of Wyoming. The first, there were a couple of dozen, and then the next year, about 90. And then usually every year, we'd have 150, 200 people, most of whom not only had sightings, but had also had what they felt were ET encounters. And so it was an interesting, that first year was interesting. People would stand around and talk, well, this is the way ETs look. No, this is the way ETs look. And I said to a couple of guys, Carl Higdon and Pat McGuire, I said, do you suppose there are more than one group of ETs? And they looked at each other, oh, maybe so. And many of these people were open not only to what was happening to them in the sense that they knew it was true, but also they knew that there was a feeling of a kind of compulsion, an obsession, as if each of these people had some kind of duty. We termed it TDY, temporary duty. That's a military term that where people are away from the main base and trying to finish some task and then return home. And many of these people felt like the stars were home. They felt like they had been from some other place, come to Earth as a human in a human body for several lifetimes, and felt like this was an important moment in, or a long dragged out moment for some of them in Earth history where they were supposed to do some kind of job, get other people be aware that ETs are around and that humans are working towards some kind of change in consciousness. So there were some people who were kind of survivalists and wanted to store food in caves in case there was some major destruction on Earth. There are other people who felt like they were teachers, counselors, nurses who were supposed to help other people who had these kind of experiences. Then there's a group of people who are kind of futurists, who had pictures of not only possible destruction of the planet, but possible okay planet and humans moving out into space agencies or space vehicles or space civilization. So there are a wide variety of interests and a wide variety of visions from various people.
And now that you bring this up, kind of relating that to in the 50s, there was the whole contactee movement. Did you work with or get to talk with some of those people? And if so, which ones? And were what they were saying similar to what you were finding in the 80s with the people you were working with?
Yeah, I'd go to some of these conferences and talk with some of these people. And a lot of my friends, you know, they're Linda Howe, she worked with a lot of these people. Richard Boylan started the ACCET, the Academy of Clinical Close Encounter Therapists. I participated in that. So there are more and more people who took various views about not only about the contactees, but about the people who call themselves abductees. I've been a failure for years. I've tried to use the term adductees because most people think, well, I was taken out of my house. I was taken out of my car. I was taken away from Earth. I was abducted, Leo. And I said, yeah, but if you talk about adductions, that means you're moving from an outer place to the main place. You know, like a high school student might say, I was abducted from high school and taken to a college campus, but it's a bigger place than my little old high school. Well, the same way, many people feel like they're taken on board a craft, taken to a system, a star system, and so they feel like Earth is just a little little spot, the boonies, boondocks, compared to the Galactic Federation. Speaking of the Galactic Federation, I got to put a plug in for the people who are having a galactic gathering in September in Denver. I don't know if you have heard about that yet or not, but
I'm one of the people.
Yeah. Oh, yes. All right.
Yeah, always, I'm on the board.
Always
so
in
thanks,
the forefront. Yeah.
I'm glad you're reminding me that. Yeah, at the, we're talking the ISGC, so I'm helping some people. It's another thing. I don't know if you heard me because I was talking about some of the criticism. I get criticized for being too conservative, and then I get criticized for being too woo-woo. So,
for being too speculative,
You can never win. But, you know, I think these messages people are receiving are important. So, yeah, we're trying to bring together a lot of people who have had or claim to have been in contact and bring them to Denver and have a conference. And, you know, my view is, sure, maybe they're all of it is fabricated. Maybe they're all internal experiences. I don't know. But maybe some of them, we know we're being visited, so maybe some of them are legit. And that would be important. And I think it's important to listen to the messages anyway.
Yes. Yeah,
so,
and go ahead.
Oh, I was going to talk about, so did you ever get to meet, like, maybe Daniel Fry or Howard Menger or some of those others?
I heard Dr. Daniel Fry talk. I met, what's his name, from...
George Adamski?
No, I didn't meet George Adamski, but the guy who developed the Psychon out in the Giant Rock, California.
George Van Tassel.
Yeah, George Van Tassel. Met Harold Sherman, who he and Ingo Swann, you know, did remote view and remote sensing or remote viewing of Saturn, and came up with information that was later verified by the NASA journeys out there. So a lot of those people And, of course, other people who were not as well known but who had just as interesting information about their ET contacts and what they were told about other star systems. So there's a lot of information, whether you look at the information that's coming out about the people in Africa who've had reports of that they had had their ancestors come down from the skies.
Mm-hmm.
The Native Americans who described the same thing, the Hopi culture, Cherokee, all over the planet, there are groups of people who have this same knowledge that their ancestors came from the skies. Right now I'm reading a book called 2012, Return of Quetzalcoatl.
Quetzalcoatl, yeah.
Quetzalcoatl, by Daniel Pinchbeck, and it's mm-hmm. amazing how much information is available that's starting to come together closer and closer.
Yeah, I've got a couple books, one from Dr. A.C. Ross. I think he is Lakota, and then another one from Rainbow Eagle, Walk in the Woods. A.C. Ross's is Mitayuki Oasin. It's called We All Are Related. And both of them talk about, yeah, all of these legends of coming from the stars and our ancestry and getting along and our interconnectedness and wonderful,
book,
wonderful stuff.
A book on the science of Dogon, you know, some years ago, a guy named Robert Temple.
Right, the Dogon.
English writer talked about the Dogons. Well, now there's a guy who's a computer geek, as he calls himself, and he's not an anthropologist, but he has shown the similarity between the Dogon tribe symbols and ancient Egyptian symbols.
Wow.
And argues very persuasively that when Atlantis went down, then people were off into Celtic or the Canary Islands or Africa or South America, so that many of these remnants of that civilization have some of the same legends and some of the same stuff on science. And that's what's so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The Dogon views on science were thought to be nonsense. Now, of course, so many physicists are gradually accepting the evidence from quantum physics that we are no longer objective observers. We are participants. And so when physicists talk that way, they are talking the same way that mystics have talked for thousands of years. So
mm-hmm.
now science and mysticism are coming together. And what's exciting to me is that the UFO experiencers also talk the same way. The surveys that I've done with UFO experiences, they say that yes, ESP, yes, reincarnation, yes, paranormal phenomena. So the studies on out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, Dean Radin's book, Conscious Universe, Claude Swanson's book on the synchronized universe, all of these books are showing that not only are, quote, paranormal phenomena, quote, normal, unquote, but also that fits in with the notion of the possible space-time travel. So many traditional scientists poo-pooed these stories because it didn't fit in with the Newtonian worldview or with a propulsion system based upon chemicals. I remember when I was a young professor at the University of Wyoming, there was a guy who came to talk about flying saucers, that can't be true. They violate the laws of physics. Well, he was a well-known professor of physics, and I was a little hesitant, but I stood up after his talk when he asked for questions. I said, have you had a UFO sighting? He said, well, no, you know, like, of course not.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, have you investigated a report of a flying saucer sighting? He said, no. Well, I sat down. I thought, what's there to talk about? Because in science, we're supposed to observe, we're supposed to examine, we're supposed to investigate.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember later when I was talking with Dr. J. Allen Hynek at the UFO panel of the National Enquirer, when I told that story, he said, well, then did you ask him what are his qualifications for being a speaker on UFO research? I said, no, he was a full professor of physics. I was an assistant professor of psychology. I didn't qualify.
I'm glad you went there, though, because that's kind of what I was getting at, is it seems like what those people you mentioned, Daniel Fry, George Van Tassel, what they were saying back then in the 50s with the contactees. And if people don't know, when I refer to contactees, these were people in the 50s who said a ship landed. You know, it was more of they're invited. Hey, would you like to come talk and fly on our UFO and we'll tell you about our culture? And these people would get information, some of them having witnesses, various witnesses who saw them with these UFOs or these other people. And during the 50s...
Go ahead.
So the contactees, the people, you know, from that you've been working with, the Native American tribes and the Dogons, who are the Africans, right?
Yes.
All having similar stories. And now, like you're talking about quantum physics, and actually, if you look into even Buddhism and Indian philosophy, is very similar, I think. And now quantum physics coming and starting to mesh and fit in with all of this.
Yeah, it makes a more coherent picture, not only historically, but also in terms of the weight that people have to give to this kind of testimony. In the 50s, the contactee stories could be dismissed by scientists who say, well, if some intelligent civilization were trying to contact us, they would contact the people who are knowledgeable, right? Well, if the people who are knowledgeable were living a world of a Newtonian physics force rather than a world of energy and consciousness, then they wouldn't pay attention. And, of course, that's what happened. That's why I like Dr. Jim Deardorff's hypothesis that any intelligent civilization would go slowly and contact us little people first. Then later the information would be available to government agencies, to high-level scientists. But right at first, it would be everyday persons. And so I think this has happened, that the UFO culture has gone from the lower middle class, if you could call that, to the middle class. Mm-hmm. Now it's moving up into the upper class, and now it's moving up into the echelons of government and military sources. We hear rumors that there are insiders who wish to have the information released, and we hear rumors that there are people who don't want the information released. And so the battle now is between the big boys. But the little boys and girls, we already know that UFOs exist and ETs exist, and they're knocking on our door, and we're trying to decide whether to open the door or not.
Right. And that's what's interesting, I think. Like, for instance, Popular Mechanics, I've been working with them for the last couple of months on a UFO story, and they didn't use any of the quotes from any of the credible people that I had brought to them, or any of my information regarding the type of reports we get with MUFON, but they used a lot of debunkers, and it really seems they're out of touch, because the little people, like you said, do seem to know for the most part.
Yeah, majority of people know that flying saucers exist. The polls have shown that over the years. Sometimes, though, of course, it seems like the media at the top level are connected with the cover-up. Hansen's book on the missing times is a good indication of that. Other people have pointed out that if a reporter goes out and has a story and comes back, then the editor may accept it or moves on up, and the higher up it goes, the less likely that story gets into the newspaper. It's obvious that the cover-up extends a long way, but I don't know if you saw that article by Dr. Scott Jones in Bridges, a journalist summer. He quotes the rumor that the Indian Space Agency, which they launched a mission to the moon, was supposed to do it in July, but it wasn't until October that it did, and the rumor is that maybe they will announce a discovery during the two-year mission of bases on the moon, ET bases. Mm-hmm. Well, if that happens, then China and Russia and Europe and the U.S., who already know about these, according to the insiders, then they would be able to make a statement about it. So it's an interesting speculation as to whether the next couple of years there might be some announcement of the ET bases, in which case then the disclosure would be underway.
Yeah, I do remember that, and that seemed, because, you know, if you monitor Indian media, they talk about UFOs and different speculations around that pretty often.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I
wanted to tell a personal example. Of course, my wife Marilyn rolled her eyes. She said, "Leo, you've been saying that for 40 years." But, I was at the gym one morning, 6 in the morning, and I was on a stationary bicycle working away, and I looked up at a TV monitor, and I saw two things at the same time. I saw an image of Joe Biden, who was at that time a candidate for Vice President, U.S., and he was being criticized by news pundits for saying that if Barack Obama were elected president, well, then he would be tested with an international crisis. And right underneath, a little running commentary was that the Indian Space Agency had launched a mission to the moon. I thought, yeehaw, that would be the crisis.
<That's>, yeah, maybe
enough,
a little...
enough crises to go around.
Yeah, no doubt about that. But yeah, maybe hopefully something that was a little prophetic. And that, it's funny you do bring up how your wife says you've been saying that for decades, because the researchers I know who have been in this for decades get to be real skeptical, because like some of them have told me, you know, I thought, you know, for sure it was the 60s. Then when, you know, with Kennedy, I thought for sure it was going to be Jimmy Carter. I thought for sure it'd be Reagan, and then I gave up, and now I don't know if it's ever going to happen.
Yeah. Well,
how do you feel?
One time we had a guest at our UFO conference in University of Wyoming, Alfred Weber, who's written a book on exopolitics, and he said that during the Carter administration he was part of a group, and they were planning on the possibility of disclosure, but of course it didn't work out. And then Dr. Stephen Greer, the physician, has described his talks with senior officials at the White House some years ago, and they thought maybe during the Clinton administration that information be released, but that didn't happen either. So now that's what Scott Jones, in his paper in 2006 at a Hawaiian conference, argues that there are three programs. One was with the assistance of a president of the United States. One was without assistance of a president, and then the program C. The other two have been tried, haven't worked. So program C, supposedly starting in 2006, was a graduated disclosure program where information would go out to various agencies or various professional groups. Information would come back. And then by the end of 2008, the information would be set, and then it would be up to the ETs to decide what they call the visiting others when they decide to have the announcement. So if that's true, that would suggest that the plans are underway, and now it's just a matter of timing.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that's true. Then I'll feel good.
Yeah.
I'll be able to walk over to the University of Wyoming campus and talk to my deceased colleagues and say, "I told you."
Yep, exactly. They'll be like,
"A little bit of ego."
Oh, he got us. But hopefully they know already.
I think so. If they're deceased, they're tuned in on the spirit world. They know that these exist, right?
Uh-huh. They passed over, and the first thing they thought was, "Dang, that Leo was right."
Maybe that wasn't the first thing. Maybe the second or third,
Second or third, you're right. There's probably some other more important things to look at there. But getting into that kind of information, well, I want to ask you about, we'll get into more about the overall messages that you've heard, but I do want to ask about a couple things in the past. Like I had mentioned Dulce earlier, and at least in my research I've read that Paul, you were working with Paul Benowitz, who brought you Myrna Hansen. Was that her name?
He didn't want me to know her name at first. Later on, when he talked about her name publicly, then I thought it was okay for me to talk about it. he didn't give me any information about her, just wanted me to do hypnosis with her and her 10-year-old son. And mm-hmm. they described what they felt was a flying saucer came down with a light to shone down and picked up a calf, a young cow, and I took it aboard. And then apparently she and her son had that same onboard experience, and she reported in a second session more about what she felt was underground base. Paul Benowitz figured it was in that area, mm-hmm. but other people have wondered if it might be not in Albuquerque area, Sandia, but in other places. I can't claim that I know whether she did or not have experience, but certainly it was very real to her, and the hypnosis session seemed, and it's reported in Linda Howe's book on alternate realities. So mm-hmm. that was a very interesting session that we had.
Did they feel that anything happened to the calf?
I'm not sure they did there, but another woman with whom Linda Howe met reported that she felt like she was watching a calf going up into the air, and then she and her daughter mm-hmm. felt were disappearing, and then she felt like she was both standing by her car in Texas looking up at the flying saucer, but also felt like she was on board. So it may have been an out-of-body experience that she was reporting. Anyway, she felt like she was seeing two little grays with long, sharp knives cutting the calf. And she was a nurse, mm-hmm. and she knew that they were doing that very skillfully. But it was kind of a traumatic event for her, and she had worked with a psychiatrist and gone through hypnosis, but she kept blocking. Well, when she came to me, I knew that we had to do something to help her get around that block. So we went through the experience. When she came to the point when she couldn't remember, I said, "We'll go on through the next experience and go on and look around at the craft and see what happens." And she comes back, and she knows that she came back, and she knows that her daughter's back. So I said, "Okay, let's go back to that point again, and you'll be able to remember." Well, she came up out of the trance state with her eyes blazing. I said, "Damn you." She was angry at me because I was giving her the suggestion that she could remember what had happened, and what she remembered was that she also saw her daughter, Cindy, on a table, and the grays were standing over, and she was afraid in her mind that maybe her daughter was going to be harmed. But what she reported was that she saw entities do scraping under her fingernails and so forth, like they were taking samples of the body. And later, another hypnosis session with Cindy revealed the same story as far as Cindy was concerned. So those kind of cases are interesting because people can say, well, it's a hoax, or people are making stuff up. But the possibility that if there's more than one witness and independently report similar memories in different sessions, then that adds to the evidence.
Right, right. Which happened about, in your history, how many times have you ran across cases like that where two people reported the same thing and shared an experience?
Yeah, there are dozens of people, husband, wife, or families.
Mm-hmm.
The problem, of course, is that hypnosis is not perceived as reliable by some people. I mm-hmm. myself try to use a cliche. The cliche is it's good for exploration, but it may or may not be good for evaluation. So add mm-hmm. the evidence from other sources to it. But what's fascinating to me is that some families will be sitting in a car looking up at a flying saucer, and later everybody will say, "Yep, yep, yep, we saw that," and then there are lights, and this is what happened. And then one person, perhaps the father driving, said, "No, it did not happen." And mm-hmm. so either people are repressing information, or else another possibility is that, for example, one couple I talked with, the husband saw one thing and the wife saw another thing. So it may well be that these things are happening not only at a physical level, not only as an out-of-body level, but also at a programming level. People may be programmed to have certain kinds of experiences. Of course, this frightens persons who think that the ETs are satanic or evil. But on the other hand, what fascinates me is that the experiences seem to be connected to the what the person can handle. It's almost as if, you know, you could get 2 third graders and 1 third grader might say, oh, the teacher, she's great. And the other goes, no, the teacher is bad. She's evil. Well, similar experiences, but different reactions to what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're back then, some of the other large cases that you worked on.
Oh, I've worked with Travis Walton, talked with people, 3 women from Kentucky. We mentioned Betty and Barney Hill. Oh, I got to tell a story about that.
Okay.
Carl Sagan was, during the TV interview, he was talking to Betty Hill. He said, now, Mrs. Hill, you say that during the hypnosis session with Dr. Benjamin Simon that you remember the examiner placing something in your navel. And she said, yes. He said, now, we're all amateur psychologists here. Then he looked over at me and said, oops, sorry about that. And I said, that's all right. My friends think I'm an amateur psychologist. He was about to tell her what she had experienced. During the break, this tall, very bright, very commanding presence of a science writer was at the hall. And he confronted me. He said, now you're a psychologist, looking down at me. I'm 6'2", and I don't know, he must have been 6'6". And when I heard him say, you're a psychologist, I said, uh-oh, here comes a lesson.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you're a psychologist. You know people see what they want to see. And I said, yes, I think you're right. I think people see what they want to see. And I said, I think people don't see what they don't wish to see. And he looked at me, and he abruptly ended the conversation because he knew what I was saying. He didn't want to see these people as honest. He didn't want to see these people as intelligent. He didn't want to see them as accurate in what they claimed to have experienced on board. My feeling was that Betty and Barney Hill were more authentic than many professors I've known who tried them. I remember going to a conference one time, and a physicist said to me after I talked about my experiences, he said, well, Leo, if I had a UFO sighting, I wouldn't talk about it. I said, why not? He said, well, I've got to maintain my credibility. And I nodded sympathetically. I understood. But I also thought sadly, well, what about your integrity? To me, this is what we're being tested. Humanity is being tested, both individually in initiations to UFO experiences, but also we're being tested as a society. When are we going to come to the point where we are honest with ourselves, knowing that we have a history of evolution, but we were created, and we are created by ETs. And the biblical story tells it very nicely, a serpent, not a snake, but a serpent, which means, you know, a critter that it was intelligent, so it talked to the people and the tree of knowledge. When were we going to find out that we came from Mars? I tell people when I go to conferences, I said, do you know that the Germans and the French scientists take people underground without clocks? They hook them up to various devices, and they get a biorhythm. And the diurnal day is 25 hours or 24 and a half hours. And I say, why is that? Because if we grew up as a human race on Earth, we would be a 24-hour day cycle critter. But the astronomers tell us that the Martian cycle is 24 hours and 37 minutes, or 24 hours and 40 minutes, whatever it is. Well, if that's true, then maybe we came through Mars on our way to Earth, and so that's why we show this different cycle. Anyway, there's a lot of information that we don't yet know about ourselves, and in my opinion, the ETs are helping us to learn about ourselves.
Yeah, there were some stories even recently of some scientists coming out talking about, and it was a big wow, even though I know Eric Von Daniken had talked about, and I know there were scientists in the 70s who were talking about this as well, but life being seeded from other planets, possibly Mars, asteroids landing here, and that's where the some of the components of life started, let alone what you're talking about. And do people give these messages of extraterrestrials being involved with somehow manipulating man in their past?
Yeah, the work of Zechariah
and women
and other people indicate that there may be more than just a group, you know, that landed in Africa or in Mesopotamia, the Sumerian religion. But it certainly, it seems like there are a lot of groups who claim that their ancestors came from the skies and helped them develop civilization. So that seems to be a part of most early civilizations or early group cultures. It'll be interesting to hear what Dr. Arthur Horn has to say. He had left CSU, you know, when he could no longer, in good conscience, teach Darwinian evolution. So he felt that humankind had a different... We have descended, not ascended from... this is what quantum physics is doing for us. You know, it used to be that the scientific view was that the physical world is real, the biological world is also important, but the study of psychological and mind stuff is not so important. And the soul, what's that? Well, now it seems it's the other way around, that it's downward causation from the spirit, energy, and consciousness moving down into the mind, moving down into biology, moving down into the physical world. So it may well be that in a few years, more and more physicists will convince more and more biologists, and the biologists will convince the psychologists, and finally my colleagues will say, huh, maybe so.
Yeah. Well, we've got a caller on the line, so let me bring her on.
Okay.
I think it's a her because there was a her in the chat that said she wanted to ask a question. Hello, caller, are you there?
Yeah.
It's a he.
Okay.
Hi there.
Hey. Hi, I'm Gabriel.
Oh, Gabriel, okay. Great, yeah. What was your question?
Oh, sorry, let me turn off the... All right. Well, I've been researching for 15 years since I saw something as a kid, and recently I saw something again this summer, more real than the last one because it was 15 years ago. And it was physical this time. But aside from me being a researcher as well, I'd like to maybe fire a few questions at him and see how he responds.
Sure. Go ahead.
All right. Well,
he's actually here, so you can direct them at Dr. Sprinkle.
This is Leo Sprinkle.
Hi.
Hi.
All right. I ran into a lot of information about these star seed, or what some people are calling indigo kids, or, well, they're not kids anymore. I mean, like, they're trying to put a word to describe some kind of trait that's showing up, and it seems like their idea is that more and more people are showing up with these traits, and that they're... like really different in a way. Do you know anything about that? Or
yeah, there's a couple of books that refer to the indigo children. Tolbert and others describe the characteristics. Also, the Star Kids by Dr. Richard Boylan. And if you are familiar with his work, then you know that he's conducted workshops for parents and children who seem to have a lot of psychic abilities and who parents feel like there's been some kind of ET connection. So there's more and more people who show an interest and who are coming together to talk about their experiences.
All right. I actually saw, or I actually heard his interview on another show on Blog Talk Radio yesterday, which is why it's on my mind. And they did, I think it's Paranormal 101, and they end up talking about star children a lot, and I don't like the names that they give them. It's too airy-fairy for me, but it's just the idea, and I'm hearing it from so many different places that I don't really know what to make of it, but almost I took the test, and out of, I think it was like 25 questions, scoring one or two if you answered yes to certain questions, I scored a 38, and that's higher than either of the hosts that were there. And it doesn't surprise me in the least. But,
right. Welcome to a different world.
Yeah. Well, it's just nice to find somebody else here.
Yes, it is. Thank you.
All right. Yeah, thanks, Gabriel. Did you have another question?
Another question?
Sure, just another quick one. It's something that's been on my mind. I was just wondering, what are your thoughts on gravity as a result of expansion rather than what we're currently proposing it as?
Yeah, I don't have good information. My training doesn't include the kind of physics and math that many other people. I'm reading some of the books and journals by people who are talking along those lines. Dr. Hal Puthoff, for example. There are other people who are doing studies about the possibility of anti-gravity being a propulsion. The Casimir effect that is in zero-point energy. So I don't have a good opinion, but there are people who are discussing the possibility that when these conditions are explored, that they will help us not only understand more about the history of the planet and the galaxy, but also be useful as space-time exploration propulsion system. So I encourage you to keep on searching, but I'm sorry, I just don't have a good opinion on the matter.
All right. Thanks, Gabriel. And, you know, it's interesting you brought that. He brought that up because Howard Menger, who was one of those contactees I mentioned, who supposedly built a UFO but had a lot of witnesses to him seeing UFOs and talking to extraterrestrials, he said that he was given the impression, you know, how to download that. Gravity was actually an expansion type of thing where it's pushing out, so you have to block it, pushing you down in order to do the anti-gravity thing. So that was kind of interesting. But, you know, on that note of the messages that people receive, first of all, I guess the types of entities or types of extraterrestrials people are experiencing. Could you talk about maybe some of the main types or the different types that people are reporting?
You're asking me, Alejandro?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, there are a wide variety of entities. I've talked to people who have seen haystacks. I've seen talked to people who have seen robots, who have talked with reptoids, insectoids, humanoids. It seems as if there's a book by a guy named Chase, C-H-A-S-E, which gives colored drawings of the various types in case people want to look at those. there are a wide variety of people who not only talk about orbs, but also feel like they have had communication with spirit entities who don't have flesh and blood bodies. So a woman whose name is Nancy Cooney wrote to me years ago. I don't have a copy of my book here, but in one of the chapters or in the her description is shown. What her reading of the literature did was interesting to me. She described the type of entity, and then she described the type of activity. Her thesis is, and of course I don't know whether it's true or not, but her thesis is that the kind of activity is an indication that people are having a display. This was what Dr. Frank Salisbury meant years ago when he wrote his 1974 book about the Utah UFO display. John Keel, Dr. Jacques Vallée, these people have all said the same thing, that the UFO experience is a display. It's meant to attract the attention of the person. Oftentimes a flying saucer is head-on to the observer. Now the question is the person going to be a witness? An observer sees something, but the witness testifies. So some people, they see something, but they don't want to testify. They don't want to talk about it. Other people, they are willing to talk about it and receive the what goes on afterwards, you know, the humiliation or the rejection or denial or whatever. So the display is not only of the flying saucer, the display is of the entities. If a person sees a flying saucer come down and little entities get out and pick up stuff on the ground, well, then these critters are concerned about environment. Robots are often associated with warlike activities. Greys oftentimes with hybrid or sexual activities. A big praying mantis type thing with meditation, prayer. Hooded creatures with religious activities. It's almost as if it's a theater, and the observer, the witness, or the participant, if he or she decides to become a participant, is being shown something. Just like a kid in school could see a soccer game and say, hey, I want to be a soccer player, or a gal might say, I want to be a tennis player. Another person might, I want to be an artist, I want to be a historian, whatever. It's almost as if people, like Gabriel was talking about, the star seed or the persons who are being inducted. Some people say, I'm abducted and I don't want to be there. But other people say, hey, I had something unusual happen to me and I want to find out about it. So they're, instead of feeling sorry for themselves, they decide to investigate and to talk with other people, share their experiences. So it seems as if all of these experiences could be seen as weird and wonderful, or they could be seen as training devices.
Right. So, and yeah, that's some of the stuff I wanted to get into with, and you put it all in a nutshell. Some of the stuff that, yeah, people experience in the different types, and you went, I didn't even have to ask, you already went into the different types of experiences and everything that they're having. Does the overall message seem to be similar?
It does if one looks at the various theaters to learn if there's a common theme. To me, it's the hero's journey. You know, Campbell was the guy who talked about the hero's journey. The woman or man who feels separated, you know, what you call initiation in societies. The boy or girl who's taken outside society and then goes through some kind of training process. It can be an ordeal, like Ulysses, you know, going for the Golden Fleece, legend, or in military service, or initiation into a college sorority or fraternity, or into a educational program. But the stages are perceived by various people differently. The general hero's journey is separation, the threshold, the initiation, and then return with the information or the knowledge. Some people perceive themselves going through the hero's journey when they have cancer or some kind of illness, or somebody who is an athlete and gets his leg chopped, or a soldier coming back from Iraq and she's been injured or whatever. There are people who have, I think everybody is on a hero's journey, in my opinion. You know, everybody is going through a soul journey and learning from it and then reporting back after the end of the lifetime and deciding, do I want to do some more of that next lifetime or do I want to do something different? Weiss, he talks about the messages from the masters on page 55 in the lower right-hand corner. There's a great line. It goes, hatred is an express train headed for the hated group. He was told by his masters that if you hate somebody, if you hate blacks or whites or females or males or communists or fascists or whatever, you're headed for that group. You can learn more about those damn people in the next lifetime. But anyway, back to the UFO experiencer, a person could see an object and then deny it. So the hero or the male or female person could be on the hero's journey but deny it. So, no, I didn't see a flying saucer. No, it doesn't mean anything to me. No. But if a person has another sighting and another, another, or abduction or sexual experience with ETs over and over and over. The task is, first of all, to be aware, and that's hard for some people. The next task is to be accepting. That's really hard for some people. Mm-hmm. But then the third part is worse yet. Yeehaw! Got to acknowledge it. Got to talk about it. Son of a gun. And then, finally, there's action. So some people are stuck on the awareness. Some people are stuck on the accepting. Some people are stuck on the acknowledgement. And some people are stuck on the action. But sooner or later, if a person keeps being bombarded, 18 or 20 years later, they say, okay, I got to do something about it. Now, some people won't. They'll go into drugs or alcohol, or they'll deny it and waste their life. And then the next lifetime, they'll start all over again. But those people who are heroes, the men and women who say, yep, I'm aware, I'm accepting, I'm acknowledging, I'm taking action, then their task is to tell other people about their experience so that people can share. And then gradually we'll all get ready for the galactic showdown. Yeehaw! When the ETs say, okay, we're here, and now do you want to prepare to become a member of the Galactic Society?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that Joseph Campbell. And I agree with you, and I've heard him state that also, that every day is a hero's journey, that your current experiences are a metaphor for your internal experiences. And I know that it's similar, and what you describe is similar with the experiencers' experiences with the extraterrestrials. There are metaphors that go back into their own being and growth.
Yeah, and when people do that, some exciting things happen. I'll give you one example. A woman from Colorado I worked with years ago, farm wife, she was driving along in a truck, and she saw a flying saucer off in the meadow, and she felt impelled to get out of her truck to go through the barbed wire fence to go inside the craft. Her memory was hazy about what happened. During hypnosis session, she felt like she was jerked around on a table by white masked entities like surgeons, and she was crying out in pain and fear, and we talked about it. In another session, she went back to what seemed to be a past life as a surgeon, and he jerked his patients around, and she immediately understood what the lesson was about. The lesson was that it ain't nice to jerk patients around. You got to be more compassionate. And so over and over, many people feel like they have been victimized by ETs. Well, the task to learn is why. I kept wondering, why do some people have a good experience? Why do some people have a bad experience? And so the more I looked into it, the more it seemed like the people were learning a lesson, so that they were finding out more about themselves and their past and how to deal with it. And so we come down, it doesn't matter whether we talk about quantum physics and energy and consciousness of the universe, or whether we talk about the mystics, the teachers, Buddha, Jesus, Muhammad. All of these people are saying over and over and over, consciousness is the stuff of the universe, and love is what makes it go around. And so, dang it, we're finding out that we got to be loving to ourselves and other people, including the damn ETs. Yeehaw.
Yeah, the Whitley Strieber movie ended with that concept of the experiences being a show, which I thought was really interesting. And then that's why I really appreciate your work, John Mack's work, Barbara Lamb's work, the psychologists in this field, because I know a lot of nuts and bolts people get frustrated. I can't get my hands around that, How do I get my hands around these ideas of these internal mechanizations, that's something that's hard to tackle. But
it seems like that's the pattern. When people look into the UFO phenomenon, the first thing is we want the physical evidence, the photographs, the landing traces, the stuff that will tell us that it's physically real. Then we want to look into the biological stuff, the ETs, and find out if are they real, are they true, and we never get enough information to be really convinced. So then we look into the mental stuff, find out what is their message, what are they trying to tell us. And then finally we look at the spiritual side, hey, we are the message. And when we recognize that, then it's not so bad to deal with the question marks that are still remaining.
Mm-hmm. By the way, which I think, you know, these perspectives are just, I think, the root of what's important for people. Because, sure, you know, it's great, and I agree. I mean, I work with MUFON. We're trying to get some evidence and help, you know, grease the wheels of all of this awakening to this reality. But at the same time, the personal experiences are important. Today, right now, is where we are, where we're existing, and it's important for people to integrate these experiences, learn from them, just like any experience, any daily experience, and use it to grow and move on and have happier, more satisfying lives.
Yes, I want to tell a story that kind of illustrates that principle. One of our sons said that one of his sons, a six-year-old, was telling his mom he wanted to grow up and be a midget. And his mother said to him, well, why? I don't think that'll happen. You'll probably grow up to be tall like your dad. Oh, darn, he said, I want to be a midget. And she said, well, why do you want to be a midget? He said, so I can run around and have fun. She said, well, you can run around and have fun now. Oh. Well, that's the same way. People are waiting and waiting and waiting to find out more about the ETs. I'm one of those. You know, I thought it would happen in the disclosure to happen in the 60s or the 70s, the 80s and 90s. Now I think it'll happen in this decade, but maybe it'll be another lifetime. Well, I'll come back and work on it some more. But the important thing is not only to keep on investigating, keep on gathering evidence, keep on presenting information as you do so well, but also part of it is to have fun while we're doing so, because this is a crucial time in human history, and it doesn't do any good for us to increase the amount of fear or anger that's already around us.
Right. By the way, when did you learn your yeehaw? Did you learn that in Wyoming?
Yes, right.
Do they yeehaw a lot out there?
A lot of yeehaw, yeah.
Well,
there
that's
was a guy,
that,
a guy I knew who was a dowser from Colorado Springs, and he had a cute cartoon. He had been at Virginia Institute, Robert Monroe Institute, you know, for out-of-body travel.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed me a cartoon of a flying saucer with a couple of strange-looking ETs in it swooping down on the streets of a city, and people were scattering, and he yelled, "Yee-haw!" As if they were spooking the cattle, you know.
Yeah. All right. Well, cool. You know, that's about it for the show. You know, I guess one last thing, because we've only got a minute here. We've got a gentleman who pops in sometimes named Pastor Pat. And, you know, he really likes to come on and talk about, oh, they're not real, that's movie, that's hogwash, blah, blah, blah. And I wanted to know, what kind of thing do you tell people? Actually, I've heard you, what you say to people. What kind of thing do you tell people like that?
Sure. If they are truly skeptical, they want to learn, I say, if they're debunkers, then I don't want to talk to them because they're no fun. But if a person is skeptical, I say, read 1,000 reports, talk to 100 experiencers, have your own experience, and then let's talk. Well, and people say, well, what do you mean, have my own experience? I say, well, look, if you went downtown and you said to merchants, I sure would like a shirt, I sure would like a shirt, and they'd nod sympathetically. But if you say, I've got $20 or $30 or whatever shirt might cost, well, then they are more interested. And so a person who says to me, I want to have a sighting, I say, okay, be careful what you wish for. You might get into more trouble. You know, it's like someone said, I want to go to college. Well, it might not be as much fun as you think it is.
Yeah.
If a person says, I want to have a sighting, then you have to decide, what are you going to do for the ETs? Now, for some people, that's easy. An engineer wants to study the craft. Biologist.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but we've got like only a couple seconds. But I know what you mean.
do something for the ET, and they'll do something for you.
Okay, perfect. Well, thank you very much. This hour went by, and it seems like a blink of time. We'll have to have you on again. Remember, everybody, Nick Pope, we're going to have March 1st, so that's going to be Sunday at noon Mountain Standard. But everybody have a great rest of your weekend, and thank you, Leo.